Have you ever been stuck in the middle of a bad situation? You know what they call that? Between a rock and a hard place. You didn't do what you should have done, and now you can't do what you ought to do. You're just kind of stuck in the middle. In the early 70s, I got a call from the Musicians Union to go down to Newport, Oregon, to play with this band that needed a guitar player. And so I went down there and we spent about 2 weeks at this place. And then when the 2 weeks were up, the band, the next gig was up in Ilwaco. And so I said, well, you know, okay, I'll go to Ilwaco and play the next gig with you. It wasn't a, you know, lifetime commitment kind of a deal, but I'll go the next 2 more weeks with you. And we got to the Ilwaco, and everything was pretty good. You know, the job was just normal. It was your basic beer joint, and from 9 to 1, we kind of played some rock and roll and country. And then we went, the drummer knew, had a friend in Ilwaco who owned this giant, beautiful Victorian house, just a couple of hundred yards off the beach. Beautiful place. Had one of those porches that go all the way around. And if I remember right, one corner had kind of a pointed, you know, whatever you call that, something at, not marionette, pirouette, minaret, whatever, something like that. Gorgeous place. There was just one problem. The house didn't have any heat. It was a oil furnace, and for the guy was broke or something, and he couldn't afford to buy oil for the furnace. So the place was just freezing in there, except in the living room, there was a fireplace that he kept going. And then at night, he had an electric heater to keep that living room heated. Now, the thing was, there were four of us in the band, and we'd be spread out in various bedrooms and stuff. But if we took turns, we sort of flipped a coin or drew straws for who got to sleep on the couch in the room where the heat was. And after 3 or 4 days, it was my turn. And I mean, those other nights, I was sleeping with all my clothes on, even my shoes, and just, you know, chattering teeth and never really getting warm. And so I thought, man, tonight I am going to sleep. So we go to work and we come home about 1:30 in the morning. And I got my sleeping bag or a blanket or something, and I stretched out on that couch and I'm sleeping. Finally, it's warm. And then about 4 o'clock or 4:30 in the morning, I heard this commotion, you know, low voices talking quietly, and I kind of shook the dust off or the sleep off, and I looked and I saw out in the living room or out by the front door, the entryway, I saw flashlight beams, 6 or 8 of them. And I thought, well, now this is unusual. And I got up and I, you know, went over and kind of opened the door because we had it all sealed off to keep the heat in. So I opened the door to this living room and there are 6 or 8 or 10 or I don't know how many police officers with flashlights and pistols. And I see them bringing from upstairs, I see them bringing a couple of the guys in the band. And it's, you know, put your hands behind your back, sir, and the cuffs go on. And I'm thinking, what in the world is this all about? And it turns out that these guys that I was playing music with had, you know, borrowed a few things from the previous job in Newport. And when the guy who owned them found out that they took them, he called the police and there were warrants for their arrest. And everybody was being put in the back of police cars and hauled off. And I remember talking to this one officer, I said, how come everybody's going to jail but me? And he said, do you want to go? And no, I don't. Take them, cuff them, haul them, you know, lock them up. I don't even know these guys. And I realized that there I was kind of stuck in the middle. I mean, I knew all along, really. I mean, I knew that when this thing was over in Newport, I should have just gone back home because these guys I knew were just a little shady. You know, you hang out with them for a couple of weeks, and I didn't expect them to be criminals, but I knew they weren't exactly choir boys either. And, you know, and I was no choir boy for that matter, but I wasn't a thief, you know, or a criminal. And these guys, it turns out, were. And so there I am in Ilwaco, stuck in the middle. It's too late to go back, to just go home and pretend it didn't happen. At the same time, I'm not in any hurry to be hauled off to the pokey with those guys. You know what I'm talking about? Stuck in the middle. Well, that's exactly where Peter finds himself in this last part of Mark 14. See, he should have bailed out with the other apostles. I mean, that's what Jesus, in a sense, told him to do, implicitly told him to do. He had said that when the shepherd, they strike the shepherd and the sheep will scatter. And then when they came to get him, he said, "Who are you looking for?" And they said, "Jesus." And he said, "Well, that's me. Let these guys go." And that was their cue. That was their hint to, you know, now's a good time to make your exit. And they all did, except for Peter. Peter made a bad decision. And he found himself, or finds himself in this passage, stuck, caught in the middle. See, what happened to Peter is his devotion turned to distance and ultimately turned to denial. But in the end, he learns a lesson about the Lord's grace. So let's read these verses in Mark 14, starting in verse 66. It says, "Now, as Peter was below in the courtyard," that would be at the high priest's house, "one of the servant girls of the high priest came, and when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, 'You also were with Jesus of Nazareth.' But he denied it, saying, 'I neither know nor understand what you're saying.' And he went out on the porch, and a rooster crowed. And the servant girl saw him again and began to say to those who stood by, 'This is one of them.' But he denied it again. And a little later, those who stood by said to Peter again, 'Surely you are one of them, for you are Galilean, and your speech shows it.'" The Galileans had a certain accent that gave them away. "Then he began to curse and swear, 'I don't know this man of whom you speak.'" Now, when it says he began to curse, it doesn't mean he began to use four-letter words and that kind of thing. It means he would say, "You know, by the stars in heaven, I swear that I don't know this guy. You know, may lightning strike me," that kind of thing, calling down a curse. "I don't know this man." And a second time the rooster crowed. Then Peter called to mind the word that Jesus had said to him, "Before the rooster crows twice, you'll deny me three times." And when he thought about it, he wept. Now, to get the most out of this passage, we need to turn to the parallel account in Luke chapter 22. So get a bookmark or hold your place somehow in Mark 14, but then find Luke 22 and kind of mark that and hang on to it. We're going to switch back and forth a little bit. You ever cough so much that every muscle in your chest and everything is just sore? I feel like I've been working out. I guess there is a good side. If you don't want to get caught stuck in the middle between the Lord and the world, you've got to, first of all, stay close. Stay close to the Lord. Now, in this first little bit, there are two dangers that we're going to look at. Danger number one is the comfort of distance. And let's look, Luke 22, verse 54. Now, this is the same event. "Having arrested him," Jesus, "they led him and brought him into the high priest's house, but Peter followed at a distance." If you don't want to get caught in the middle, you got to stay close. See, Peter wouldn't walk with Jesus, but he couldn't walk away from Jesus. His flesh wouldn't let him walk with Jesus. It was too dangerous, he felt, but his pride wouldn't let him walk away. See, Peter hadn't lost faith. He hadn't changed his mind about the Lord or lost interest in the things of God, but he wasn't willing to risk staying close to the Lord. And as a matter of fact, it could possibly have cost him his life had he hung in there. Could have been four crosses on Golgotha, and, you know, we'll never know. But he chose not to stay close. He chose to follow at a distance. See, staying close to Jesus, it can cost you. In fact, I'll go so far as to say it most likely will cost you. For example, staying close to Jesus can cost you friendships, friends, because your interests change. Stopping for a cocktail or five, even on Friday night, just doesn't seem to fit anymore with you. You know, watching those raunchy movies, whether they're rated PG, R, or whatever, I don't know about all that stuff. But watching those movies are basically, you know, what's come to be sex-oriented entertainment. TV, you know, network TV. I used to make fun of my mom for watching soap operas because they were so racy, and now it's like, you know, kids' shows. TV, movies, magazines, romance novels, all of that stuff, it's entertaining, but it's sex-based, and after a while, if you're staying close with the Lord, you lose interest in that stuff. Those things lose their appeal, and then, you know, all the things that your friends invite you to do, after you say no thanks enough, it seems like eventually they stop calling. Do you want to go do this? Well, no, not really. I don't watch that. Those movies. Well, do you want to go hang out here? No, I'm not really comfortable going there. You're not laying a trip on them, and you're not trying to be legalistic about it. You're just not, that doesn't fit you anymore. And after you turn down those invitations, after a while, they stop calling. So staying close to the Lord can, in some cases, cost you friends. Staying close to the Lord can cost you money. You ever think of that? See, because now you do business honestly. You don't pad the bill or the bid. You don't try to figure out what's the most I can possibly squeeze out of this turnip and then work the paperwork, you know, to get the maximum dollar. And, you know, you now go the second mile maybe to make sure that there's a certain quality to your work, and sometimes that costs you a little more. You may even tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to the IRS. And that can cost you money. But you know, the main thing following the Lord or staying close to the Lord will cost you. It'll cost you the only way of living that you've ever known. The life that up to the point you surrender yourself to Him is the only life you know. That's a big cost. Now, for some people, that's the point. For some people, that's the appeal. That was my case. You know, you have hit bottom so hard, you are so tired of bouncing your head off that brick wall, that you finally get to the point where you say, Lord, I need a new life. I want a new way of doing things. I want to change. I want to let go and escape, get away from the old way of living. So in some cases, that's, you know, that's a plus. But there are others for whom it's just more comfortable to keep the Lord at a safe distance. You know, not walking away from Him, not abandoning Him completely, but just keeping a distance. You know, their lives aren't shipwrecked. They're doing okay. They're, you know, there's this business about a relationship with God that sounds like a good idea, but they're not exactly desperate to surrender everything they have to the Lordship of Jesus Christ. So they follow Jesus at a comfortable distance. But see, when you do that, you never know what it's like to be in fellowship with Him. When you follow the Lord from a distance, you don't know what it's like to experience His presence, His power, His influence. You don't know what it's like to be filled and empowered and directed by His Spirit. You don't know what it's like to walk in His plan and His purpose for your life. You never know what it's like to know that no matter what happens, it's going to work out because He's with you and you're with Him. That's the comfort of distance. That's danger number one. Danger number two is the comfort of the enemy's fire. Look at verse 55, still in Luke 22. It says, "Now when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them." See, now Peter's not just keeping his distance. Now he's sitting with the enemy, enjoying the warmth of their fire. And you can almost hear the wheels turning in Peter's head as he's out there kind of, you know, trying to warm up and go, you know, it's, why not? I mean, it's just a fire. What would be the point of getting cold? Would the Lord prefer that I be uncomfortable out here and freeze? You know, what's so wrong with keeping warm? It's just a fire anyway. Well, the enemy's fire is anything and everything that provides comfort while you're denying the Lord. Anything that brings comfort while you are keeping your distance and denying the Lord. And what's so wrong with it is that that's a place God's people should never be. We should never find ourselves in that situation. I'm sure you've heard in wartime the idea of giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Now, in our country, that's a capital offense. If you're found guilty of that, you know, they'll lock you up or worse. Well, this is kind of the reverse case. What we're talking about here is when the enemy gives aid and comfort to you. But if you stay close to the Lord, the enemy will never have that chance. But haven't we all done that? Haven't we all, on occasion, warmed ourselves at the enemy's fire? You know, something goes wrong, things get a little rough, and so we say, to heck with it. I'm going to go where I know I shouldn't go. I'm going to do what I know I really shouldn't do, and I'm going to hang out with the people that I know I really shouldn't be hanging out with. And I have to wonder, why would God's people ever intentionally put themselves in a situation that's going to encourage us to abandon our faith? Because that's what Peter's facing here. And that's what we face when we put ourselves in that situation. As he sat around the fire there, what do you think the conversation was about? Remember now, it's the wee hours of the morning. It's sometime shortly before sunup. There's this kangaroo court going on at the high priest's house. All the elders of Israel are there. Now, they have to be there at night on the sneak because it's not legal to have this kind of a trial, this kind of a meeting at night. It's supposed to happen in the light of day, but they're kind of pulling this off, Mark told us last week, by trickery. All the elders are there. The servants are outside now. They've watched this commotion as this, how many, 100, 200, this large crowd of people, of guys with clubs and swords have now dragged Jesus into the high priest's house, and the servants, and they're all out in the courtyard, you know, kind of wondering what's going on, and somebody says, oh, let's start a fire to keep warm. What do you think that conversation around that fire was like? I got a hunch. I got a pretty good idea. I don't think they were talking about the weather. See, Peter here has surrounded himself with skeptics, doubters, mockers, and liars. And not one of them know anything about Jesus. But here around the fire, they're all experts. You know what I mean? Well, you see, I heard that he told his people that they had to drink his blood and eat his body. These people are cannibals. Oh yeah? Well, I heard that he was going to tear down Herod's temple in 3 days. Well, he never said that. Well, you know, I heard that this guy does miracles, but you know, I mean, everybody, come on, everybody knows that that's impossible. There's no such thing as a miracle. And there's Peter, soaking it all in, fanning the flame of his own doubt. You know, even John the Baptist had to send messengers and say, are you really the one? Remember when Jesus came to John? And as Jesus came up out of the water, it says that the heavens were opened and the Spirit descended on him and a voice spoke, this is my beloved Son whom I love. And John was standing right there still with the water dripping off of him. I mean, if that's not convincing, if that's not an experience that kind of settles the issue once and for all, then what is? But even John, as he sat in prison, had to send messengers. Are you really the one? And now Peter, after all his time walking with the Lord, Peter walking on water with the Lord, serving the bread and the fish, the miraculous catch. There when Jesus raised that little girl. There when Jesus raised Lazarus. There, you know, practically every miracle, even a part of some of those miracles. But now, Jesus has been arrested. The whole thing's coming to an end. What's going to happen? And he's around. He's surrounded himself with these people who are mocking. They're skeptics. They're doubters and they're liars. And it just feeds that whole, well, maybe he's not the Lord. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I've been made a fool of. And that whole chain of thought just had to be rolling around in his head. See, that's what happens when you sit around the comfort of the enemy's fire. It always discourages faith. But, you know, you're just looking for comfort. That's all. But what you're doing is you're exposing yourself to those things that discourage your faith. Why do you think the enemy makes it so comfortable? Because that's what he wants to do. He wants to destroy your faith. And here's Peter. He's supposed to be staying close to the Lord, but he's following at a distance and he's warming himself at the enemy's fire. You know, staying close to the Lord isn't always the most comfortable option. Sometimes distance does feel better, you know, and sometimes it's the enemy's fire that brings comfort, but then you find yourself, as Peter does here, stuck in the middle. It's too late to go back. But he also is afraid to speak up and move forward. He's keeping his distance. He's enjoying the comfort of the enemy's fire. See, stuck in the middle is not where you want to be when it comes to the Lord. If you don't want to get stuck in the middle, you've got to stay close. That's the first thing. The second thing is you've got to stay true. You've got to stay true to the Lord. Now, earlier back in Mark 14, you held your place, didn't you? Back in Mark 14, we saw Peter declare his loyalty, his undying loyalty to the Lord. Look at 14:29. Peter said to him, that is said to Jesus, even if all are made to stumble, yet I won't be. You know, you can count on me. And Jesus said to him, assuredly I say to you that today, even this night, before the rooster crows twice, you'll deny me three times. But he spoke more vehemently, more passionately. If I have to die with you, I won't deny you. And they all said likewise. You know, Lord, even if I have to die, I'll never follow you at a distance. I'll never warm myself at the enemy's fire. I'll stay close. I'll stay true. I'll never deny you. Now, Mark doesn't say much about these three denials. And I have to wonder if it's not because Mark's given us Peter's version. If you were Peter, would you, you know, draw everybody's attention to probably the greatest failure of your life? Maybe not. You might kind of skim over some of the details. And that's what seems to be happening here in Mark. We're on 14 still, verse 68. Well, let's back up. And when she saw Peter warming himself, one of the servant girls, she looked at him and said, you also were with Jesus of Nazareth. But he denied it. There's number one. Saying, I neither know or understand what you're saying. And he went out on the porch and a rooster crowed. And the servant girl saw him again and began to say to those who stood by, this is one of them. But he denied it again. Denial number two. And a little later, those who stood by said to Peter, "Surely you are one of them, for you're a Galilean and your speech shows it." You know, we can tell by your accent, y'all, that y'all are one of them. You're not one of us. And he began to curse and swear, "I do not know this man of whom you speak." Denial number three. Now, Luke, back in Luke 22, fills in the details a little more elaborately than Mark does. Now, remember, Luke's account is based on a couple of years of research. Luke wasn't there, but while Paul was locked up in Caesarea, Luke kind of made the circuit there in Israel, talking to everybody he could find, talking to Jesus' mom and his aunts and all of his followers to get all the stories. Probably spoke to Matthew and you know, James and all the guys. And so he has this more of a, what would you call that, biographical account of what went on there. So here we are, Luke 22, verse 56. "And a certain servant girl, seeing him," seeing Peter, "as he sat by the fire, looked intently at him and said, 'This man was also with him.' But he denied him," denied Jesus, "saying, 'Woman, I do not know him.'" This guy was with him. "I don't know him." And after a little while, that's denial number one. Number two, "And after a little while, another saw him and said, 'You also are of them.' But Peter said, 'I am not. I'm not one of them. I don't know him. I'm not one of them.'" And then 59, "Then after about an hour had passed," you know, Jesus is in the high priest's house at this phony trial, "another confidently affirmed, saying, 'Surely this fellow also was with him, for he is a Galilean.' Peter said, 'Man, I do not know what you're saying.' And immediately the rooster crowed, and the Lord turned and looked at Peter as they bring Jesus out of the house. And then Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said to him, 'Before the rooster crows, you'll deny me three times.' So Peter went out and wept bitterly." Whenever I read these last couple of verses, I always try to see it. You know, the movie in my mind. How did this go down? There they are gathered around the fire, all the religious people, and have Jesus in the house with this kangaroo court. Peter's, you know, "I don't know him. I'm not one of them. I don't even know what you're talking about." And the rooster crows for the second time. And at that very moment, they lead Jesus out of the house. Now, he's beaten up a little bit. Not nearly as bad as he will be before they're done with him. But he's been smacked around and kicked and spit on, and so he's got to look a mess. And they drag him out, and Peter, you know, looks up, and they bring Jesus out, and their eyes meet. There's this locking of the eyes. And I can try to imagine what, you know, Peter. And then I try to imagine the Lord. And sometimes, you know, some people give the impression that when Jesus was dragged out of the house and looked at Peter, it was kind of one of these. "You know, I told you, you rat, you deny me three times." But I don't buy that at all. I'm thoroughly convinced, and this is just my sense of things from the Word and in the Spirit, that's all I can say, is that when Jesus locked eyes with Peter, there wasn't anger and condemnation and bitterness and "see, I told you." It wasn't any of that. It was just this look of loving compassion. Peter. Cock-a-doodle-doo, you know. Because Jesus did animal impressions, I'm sure. Sorry. Notice the progression here Peter's gone through. Notice all the steps here of this thing. Following at a distance leads to enjoying the comfort of the enemy's fire, which leads to denying that you know him personally, which leads to denying that you're one of them, one of His people. Which leads to denying that you even know what they're talking about. Can you relate to that? Have you ever been stuck in the middle? Well, no, I don't really know. I wouldn't say I know the Lord. Who can know the Lord? As a matter of fact, I'm not one of those Bible-thumping Jesus freaks. I'm not one of them. In fact, I really don't even know what you're talking about. This whole progression of not staying close and not staying true. See, that is the pattern that we see in Peter. It's the pattern that we're all in danger of following. We let a little distance come between us and the Lord. I mean, at one time we were right there. We're with Him. But we let a little distance come in between us. We blow off Bible study and we forget about fellowship and we kind of fall back as He seems to move forward without us. We get so caught up in the things of the world, these temporary things of the world, that the eternal life in the Lord just slips, you know, lower and lower in importance to us. Instead of putting Him first, we put Him second and then third. And then ultimately, if we keep going that direction, we put Him last. And then we find ourselves with a hole in our lives where the Lord used to be. But we have distanced ourselves from Him. And we fill that hole with the comforts of the enemy's fire. I mean, it feels good. It really does feel good. It's cold out there without the Lord, you know. We need to warm up a little bit. And we justify it in our heads. And then when someone asks us about our relationship with the Lord, we're so embarrassed, we're so uncomfortable with the way we've let things get that we deny Him. No, I guess I don't know Him. I'm not one of them. I really don't even know what you're talking about. Matthew 10:32. Write this, just note the passage. You don't have to turn there. Let me remind you, Matthew 10:32, Jesus says, "Whoever confesses me before men, him I will also confess before my Father who's in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, him I will also deny before my Father who is in heaven." Ouch. That's a scary proposition. Fortunately, that's not the end of the story with Peter, and it's not the end of the story with you, with me, either. If you don't want to get stuck in the middle, you got to stay close, and you got to stay true. You can avoid the whole thing in the first place. But if you do find yourself stuck in the middle, just like Peter did here, you need to remember grace. God's amazing grace. Back in Mark, look up in chapter 16. Now we're going to cover chapter 16 in a few weeks, but I just want to jump ahead a little bit. Chapter 16, verse 7. Actually, we need to back up a little bit to verse 6. Now where we're at here, this is after the resurrection. And people have come to the tomb looking for Jesus, expecting His dead body to still be there. And they come across an angel. And the angel says, "Don't be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth who was crucified. He's risen. He's not here. You know, He's not in the grave. See the place where they laid Him? He's not there. But go, tell His disciples and Peter that He's going to into Galilee. Before you into Galilee, there you'll see Him as He said to you. Tell the disciples and tell Peter too." See, the Lord knew. The Lord knew what Peter was. Well, didn't He predict it? "Before the rooster crows twice, you'll deny me three times." And guess what? That's exactly what happened. Jesus wasn't in shock or surprise over this. He knew Peter. He knew Peter's heart. He also knew what was going to happen. And so the angel said, "Tell the disciples, tell those 10 guys who scattered like sheep, and Peter, because he's out weeping bitterly, thinking he's failed the Lord. But the Lord knew Peter's heart, and the Lord had a plan for Peter. He didn't cut him off. You remember Jesus had said already, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Let me remind you, it was Jesus that said that. Obviously, he knows that. He understands that. The spirit is willing. Our born-again spirit wants to please the Lord and stand firm and stay close and stay true and all that. But this flesh is a little weak. But here's the good news. Remember 2 Timothy 2:13, where it says, if we are faithless, he remains faithful. Because he can't deny himself. We might blow it. We might slip away. We might not stay close. We might not stay true. We might be faithless. But even in that case, the Lord remains faithful to us. Now, before we go any further, I've got to warn you, don't mistake the Lord's patience for tolerance. The fact that he doesn't bring the hammer down on Peter doesn't mean that what Peter did was okay. But the Lord knew Peter's heart, and he knows your heart. See, if you've really surrendered your life to the Lord, you can know that he won't turn his back on you if you lose the battle with the flesh once in a while. Now, isn't that good news? He won't turn his back on you when you lose that battle with the flesh once in a while. I myself have some experience with recovery. And I know there's a lot of folks in our fellowship that do addiction recovery. And I know that, well, I've done it and I've seen it time and time again where someone will be, you know, they will make the decision that this way I've been living is not working, it can't work. I'm going to live for the Lord. It's the only thing that will work. And that includes I'm going to give up these bad habits and I'm going to begin these good habits and work them into my life. And that's a wonderful thing. You're saying, praise the Lord, hallelujah. Then after a season, though, maybe a short season, more often than not, there's a bit of a slipping back. Just maybe once, maybe twice, you know. Oh, I did it. I promised I wouldn't, but I did. I had some. I had a little. I'm not going to keep doing it, but, you know, I did it. And people will come to me and, Pastor, the Lord just must hate me now. I've blown it. I love the Lord and I want to please him, but I really tried my best, but I just didn't. And I don't know what happened. And now here I am. And I guess I'm just out in the cold, out of luck. It's all over. God's through with me. Don't let the screen door, you know, hit me on the way out of God's kingdom. And I get the opportunity. I have the privilege and the pleasure of saying, you know what? Here's the issue. If you're given over to sin, whatever it might be, then you might have something to worry about. Because giving over to means you just forget it. I'm going for it. I'm jumping in with both feet. I'm not slipping anywhere. I'm stepping intentionally, willfully, knowingly. I know the consequences. I'm walking away from the life I thought I wanted, and I'm going back into the old life and just giving over to it. Then you might have something to worry about. But if there's a struggle, I want to live in a way that's a blessing to the Lord, and I want to receive the fullness of the Lord in my life, and I blew it, I messed up, I slipped up, but I'm not giving up. I'm not giving over to that. I'm giving over to the Lord. I'm surrendered to the Lord. And yeah, I blew it, but that doesn't define me anymore. What defines me now is that I'm in a love relationship by grace through faith in Jesus Christ. And then I get to say, you know what? You're going to be okay. And that was Peter. Peter didn't walk away from the Lord. He wasn't given over to the enemy's fire. He wasn't committed to keeping Jesus at a distance. He blew it for a minute, but his heart never left. And Jesus knew that. And so he said, the angel said, go tell the disciples and tell Peter. You know, he's in this too. He is one of them. He does know him. He does know what everybody's talking about. you lose that battle, and it just means that you need to get closer to the Lord so that His Spirit, who is stronger than the flesh, is right there with you, close to you, when you need it. And we need it all the time. Amen? Staying close to Jesus, staying true to Jesus, remembering the grace of Jesus. That's the recipe for, like the old song says, staying under the spout where the glory comes out. It doesn't mean you'll never have hassles in your life. In fact, we can pretty much guarantee you will. Maybe even because of your faith. But even if you do, or when you do, I should say, you'll know that the Lord is right there with you. He said, I'll never leave you or forsake you. You stay close. You stay true. You remember grace. And you never need to be stuck in the middle between the world and the kingdom of God again.